Thank you, Nancy. Good morning, everybody. My name is Vicki, and I am an alcoholic. Before I get started, I would like to thank the committee for asking me to come and share this weekend. And thank you to John and Marilyn for all your hard work and for the emails and invitation. And thank you to Angela for inviting me to spend the weekend at her home one more time. It's been great coming up here. I've been to this roundup several times over the years, and it's always been one of my favorites. So to be invited to speak here is indeed an honor for me. I always get a bit of a giggle when I'm told or I'm asked that I'm going to be the spiritual speaker. I just find that way too amusing, and you'll find out why in due time. Are you getting a feedback? I'm getting a feedback. Are you getting a feedback, Bob?
Sounds good in the headphones.
Can we all have those? Oh.
I'm just a little self-centered.
No jokes. Okay. I don't know where to begin now. I guess I should start by telling you that I started drinking as a young child. Actually, there's one other person here in this room today who was there that day. And it was New Year's Eve. I had just started high school in northwestern Ontario. And we were, our family was visiting another family, and we kids were out skating on the lake. And the boy who lived at the house told us that his parents had a bottle of dandelion wine in the basement that the adults weren't drinking anymore. And so we went and stole it and took it out to the lake. And I had a drink of it, and it tasted really bad. And my brother had a drink of it, and I don't know what his thoughts were. And my sister Barb, who's here, and Carl each had a drink of it. I don't know whether or not Barb or Carl had any more of it. I do know that my brother and I had several more drinks, because after I got past the taste of it, I realized that it did a really nice thing. It changed me from being awkward and gawky and without shape to being shapely and graceful and poised. And suddenly I was very well educated too, as I recall. And I was quite witty, I think. Or at least I thought so. And so the next morning, I looked in the mirror, and there I was, gawky and awkward without shape again. And I didn't have the education either, so I made a decision. I was going to get more of that stuff. Maybe find some that was a bit better tasting, but get more of it, whatever it was, you know. And so instantly, I was hooked on the effect. Instantly. So I am what you would call an instant alcoholic, I suppose. Now, I didn't immediately lose my husband and kids. I was 13. That was going to come a little bit later. But didn't go to jail that night either. But I had that effect. And I woke up the next morning looking for that effect. I don't remember having a hangover. I don't think I did. I don't remember being sick. Mind you, most of my life from then till 1975 is hearsay anyway, because I was a blackout drinker too. And I don't remember if I had a blackout that night or not, but I had lots of them. So I went back to school after the school holidays, the Christmas holidays that year, and I sought out those kids that I thought could assist me in this quest for alcohol. And that meant, therefore, that I had to hang out with kids that were a lot older than me. It was in the 60s in northwestern Ontario, and the drinking age was 21. I was 13. I'm sure you can do the math. And so, anyway, a few years later, my father decided that we needed to leave that little village and move west. I wasn't too thrilled about the idea. I didn't want to leave. But at that time, I couldn't see any other option for me. Well, I tried a few options. I went to the rest of the family, my aunts and uncles and stuff, that lived there, and I asked if I couldn't live there with them, and they just said no. And I realized today it was probably a good thing, but more importantly, who would want a kid like me? I had been drinking by then for a couple of years. I was hanging out with kids that were not doing very well in school. They were shoplifting. They were getting caught shoplifting. Most of them were on probation. Most of the, well, all of the jewelry and lipstick makeup that I owned, I had stolen. Most everything I had was contraband of some kind from somewhere, either my own activity or somebody else's, in their fit of generosity. We're really, you know, generous with stolen goods, I think. So I would get gifts from my friends. My dad decided to move to Ontario, from Ontario to British Columbia, and I remember we were, I don't know, maybe just this side of Winnipeg, just this side of Regina, somewhere around there. And I made there was sort of a revelation. There was that one of those moments of clarity. By then I had had 2 days without drinking, maybe. I have to back up a little bit. My parents are not drinkers. The family parties used to take place at our home because we had the family farm. But they're not big drinkers. And so if they had alcohol, they had some drinks. If they didn't, they didn't. It wasn't, I don't remember, you know, spending, I remember spending a few times when we were in the car in the beer parlor parking lot, but it was never in our hometown. It was always when we were somewhere else visiting somebody else in the family, and they would, you know, we're going to the bar, and so the kids will play in the car or in the park next door or whatever. But it wasn't, you know, it's not a big part of my life. I don't remember me being neglected. I don't remember going hungry. My father has a problem with rage, I think, sometimes, or he did then. I don't know if he still does, but, you know, for the most part, I had all of my creature comforts taken care of. So I'm not a product of environment in the sense that it was something that I saw as the solution in my home. That was something I discovered all by myself. I thought that made me a little bit more clever than them, perhaps. So we start out and I'm on the prairies and I get this moment of clarity comes and it was sort of like, you know what, here's an opportunity for me to make some changes. Maybe I won't do it the same way when we get there. Maybe I'll do it a little bit differently when we get there. Maybe I'm not going to hang out with those kids that are always on probation. So I didn't know how that was going to happen. I didn't know what that looked like. I just remember having that feeling. What I didn't realize was I was going to have that same feeling many, many times in the future. And they always had to do with being on the move from one location to another. I came to know that that was called geographical cure. However, we arrived out this way. We stopped in Hope for a short time. And I realized we weren't going to be staying in Hope because I'm quick, I can figure things out. My dad was not looking for property in the Hope area. He was looking in Little Fort up around Kamloops, and he was looking in around Aldergrove, Abbotsford way. So I thought, okay, one last party. And so I partied hardy while we were in Hope. And when Dad told us that we were moving to Aldergrove, I had that blowout party with those kids, and I never told them where we were going. And we left Hope, and I had no more contact with those kids again. So we moved to Aldergrove, right in the heart of Mennonite country. And so there was my solution. I was going to go to the church with these kids, those Mennonite kids. So I started going to the church with these Mennonite kids, but they just didn't quite cut it. And then, you know, and then, so I found the excuse, we all always will. I realized they were hypocrites. And God spare me from hypocrites. I may be many things, but I'm not a hypocrite. Because there they were, preaching on Sunday, and these kids were sneaking out partying on Friday night, Saturday night, and you know, and their kids were getting pregnant too out of wedlock, and they were being shipped off to places and stuff, and so I thought, well, who needs this? At least I'll go back with the real people where there's drinking and we don't pretend about it. And so I found the party kids and I went right back to the party again. I don't know how long that cure lasted, but at least what I do know is that was 1963, 64, something like that. I was in grade 11. I somehow finished high school the next year. I graduated from high school, a bit shy of credits, but I got out nonetheless. I was partying solidly for the last year and a half that I was in school. And I just moved on from there. Around about that time, they were doing things like Woodstock and the Aldergrove Be-In, it was called. And so there was this magic little substance introduced to our neighborhood called marijuana. And I had escalated. I was 13 when I started drinking, and so I had to hang out with older people in order to get my supply, and that didn't change. And there I was graduating from high school, and I was hanging out with people that were in their late 20s, and they were a bit more conservative, and they didn't want to do this substance, as I call it, you know. And so I didn't get involved with it right away. But some few years later, I did. But in the meantime, I did get married, and I had a couple of kids. And I was pregnant with my second daughter, with my second child, rather, and I realized that I didn't want to stay married with this man, that I needed to go. It was another one of those alcoholic ideas that seemed like a good idea at the time. And it was time to go. And however, I was pregnant with this baby, and so I carried on, and when she was just a few months old, I left. And I left our oldest child, our son, with his dad, and I packed up the baby and put her in the car, and we moved to Prince George, and we were there for a while, and we moved to Kamloops, and her dad took her on holidays, the baby. She was by then a little over a year, and he took her for a few weeks in the summer that year, and she came back a changed child. And even in my alcoholic state, I realized that I was not a very good mother, and that she would do better if she went to live with her dad and he wanted her. And so I sent my daughter to live with her dad. So he had both kids. And that was in a time when, you know, the fathers were not the single parent. And, you know, I carried that shame around with me. By that point in time, I was drinking daily. I was drugging regularly. Whatever. I was one of those, you know, you hand me something to put in my mouth, I'll put it there. I don't ask questions. I don't care where it came from. I don't care if I know you or not. Nothing matters. So my kids I'm free now. I had absolutely no responsibilities. And when I was crying about, you know, having had these responsibilities, now I'm crying about, look at what he did to me, the son of a bitch took the kids away, you know, that kind of stuff. You just couldn't win with me, because it was always going to be your fault. And I was living in Kamloops at that time, and I was working in a high school, a junior high school, on the front desk, and I was quite often drinking with the kids from the school. That year, towards the end of the school year, I decided that Kamloops was too small. It was, you know, I'd been there for almost a year, and too many people were knowing too much about me. It was time to move on. And so I was getting ready to leave the town, and I thought it would be a really good idea if I didn't have to pay rent anymore. So I moved into my car. It was a 63 Chev, so it was a pretty big car, and you know, I could sleep across the seat without too much injury, and I was pretty young and supple, and it just made a lot of good sense to me. Thanks, Angie. And so I was living in my car. You know, I was sober a long time before I realized I was homeless. I never thought of myself as being homeless, because I had a Chevy, and it made sense to me. Thanks, Nancy. Anyway, I did move back down to the coast, to be closer to my kids, who were living by then with their father in Alder Grove again. I'm not going to belabor this story. It just goes on like that. More and more of the same old, same old. The people were the same, you know, different names, new faces, same behavior. I drank in the bar. I loved bars. You know, my first encounter with the beer parlor, I think I was 16 years old. It was a mad, passionate love affair for a long, long time. That was the place for me to go. I loved beer parlors. First time I drove a car was another one. I love driving cars. I was a driving drunk, drinking drunk, driving drunk. And it was not uncommon for me when I lived in Kamloops, especially for some reason, to come to in Kelowna, Prince George, Vancouver, have the keys to the vehicle in my pocket, not have any recollection of the trip whatsoever, and have to go and look and see if my car was outside and realize, yeah, there it was. And I must have done the driving because here I am. And I have no recollection of the trip whatsoever. My last recollection would be being in the bar in Kamloops the night before somewhere. And I'm not one to ever leave before I had to, so I know I never left the bar till closing time. I just know it. Unless they kicked me out first. Maybe that would have happened. I might have got a little early start, but that was it, you know. And so that was my life. Now, I worked. I always worked. Because there was no damn way I was going to count on you to supply my alcohol. You were probably not going to supply it soon enough or long enough for my satisfaction. So I had to have income. And that was my only source, that was my only reason for working, was to have the income so I could drink the way I needed to. And even I knew at that point it was no longer a want to, it was a need to. I needed to drink like that. There was just no other option. If I could have figured out a way to make sure that I could have alcohol without working, I guess I might have done something, but I couldn't think of a way. I thought about going into prostitution at one time, but then I thought, no, that's going to take way too much work. It was way easier to be a secretary. The last year of my drinking, I did fall into a wonderful job. I went to work in a foundry. I was the only woman there, and I was the only one in the office. And so I could have my bottle at my desk. And I wasn't bothered by anybody about it. And in fact, I would go at lunchtime quite often. I would go for lunch with my bosses and we'd start drinking at lunch together at the restaurant. And sometimes I didn't even get back to work. And somehow they tolerated that, and I don't know why, but they did. So in 1975, I'm back living in Vancouver, or Langley, actually. And by this time, I've moved in with another man. And you know something? All that time, I'm thinking, there were men kind of in and out, but nothing permanent going on. Like Larry talked about those long-term affairs, that, you know, the overnighters. The serial monogamy overnight. And, it was too much bother. It was just too much bother to have men around. They took grooming and feeding and things, and I just couldn't, you know. I didn't even have plants, for Pete's sake. But for some reason, at the end of it all, it was like Easter of 1975, and I'd moved to Langley. I'd moved to the city. I'd grown up in the country thinking I'm in the wrong place, I'm the wrong person in the wrong place, and I moved to the city. I always thought I was a city person. And I lived there for a while and nothing changed and thought, well, I guess I've made a mistake. I really am a country girl. So I wound up back in Langley again, and I was still working in Vancouver. So I'm driving back and forth, and you can imagine the shape I was in because I was drinking till closing time or whatever. And at any rate, I moved in with a man that I had known way back in my teens, and his wife had died in a car accident and left him with two little kids. And so he had a live-in housekeeper care person for the kids. So there I was. I was living in this new house with a servant, if you like, I suppose. I had a new car, a Toyota, and I had... all I had to do with my money, I was working still at the foundry. All I had to do with my money was fill up the liquor cabinet. Everything else was provided. It was better than homeless. And so I would stop at the liquor store and fill up the trunk of the Toyota. And I didn't even have so much pride as to pick different liquor stores. I hear people say that, and I'm like, wow, I didn't have that much pride. I didn't give a shit if you knew I was an alcoholic. It was obvious. I mean, you know, I never even thought about it. I just went to the liquor store. I went to the one I knew. Why would I go to a different one and have to find where the liquor I needed was? That was too much work. Just went to the same one, get it memorized, go where I gotta go to pick up what I need, and fill up the trunk of the Toyota, go home, bring it in, put it on the table, drink it, pass out, get up the next day, and do that all over again. Remember I said I had a love affair with beer parlors? That year, some paranoia took hold of me and I could no longer go to the beer parlor. I couldn't go. I don't know what I thought was going to happen. I had a terrible paranoia about being out anywhere that year. Also that year before, I had been actually dating a psych professor the year before, and in one of his courses, one of the nights that he had to give a lecture on alcoholism, it was required. And so he went down to central office, I guess, that's I realize now, and he came back with these pamphlets, and he phoned me up and said he had a new batch of wine and a new batch of dope, and come on over. So I went over, and he's telling me the story about going to this place where these nice people, very nice people, and about talking to them about alcoholism, and he had all these pamphlets, and he said, and take a look at this. And it was what I now know was the Who Me, and it was the 20 questions. And he said, do those for fun. So I went down, and he's in another room. I don't want him to know the answers to my answers to these. So I go down. For the first time, I went from the top to the bottom instead of the bottom up. And I wasn't going to cheat this time. I was going to be truthful. And so I answered the questions, and I got 18 yeses. And it got to the bottom, and it said, if you've answered yes to three or more of these, you're definitely an alcoholic. And I thought, boy, they're really extreme. They'll go in any length to get new members, won't they? And so I thought, three is not enough. Three can't be right. That's not enough. Three yeses. Everybody's got three yeses out of this bunch. I'm sure of it. So the test is defective. Toss it aside. But for the next year, I kept trying to change some of those yeses to no. And the only two that I didn't answer yes to were, had I ever been hospitalized and had I ever been institutionalized? Well, I'd never been to jail. But I remember one night in Kamloops drinking and drugging all day, smoking dope, and then thinking I was angry about something, and I thought, they'll be sorry, I'm going to go to jail. And so I drove around the city of Kamloops, over every one of those stupid bridges, looking for a roadblock, and there weren't any. And it was New Year's Eve. And I was like, well, that's not right. So I went to the party, and I'm in high dudgeon. Imagine, with my tax dollars, they didn't even put me in jail. They didn't even stop me. They're not even there. Somebody should do something about this. And then I drank. And so that's the only reason I didn't get to go to jail, is because I just never got caught. And then the other one about the hospitalization, and these are not things I remembered at that point. These are just the two no's that I got out of the thing. The hospitalization one, in 1974, this was yet to come, 1974 at Easter, just before Easter, I had been drinking all day long. Before that, I had gone to my doctor, and I wasn't one for tranquilizers for some reason. I don't know why. I just never quite got onto them. And I used to use them to trade for alcohol in the bar. I could get them from the doctors without any problem, but I didn't use them. So I would trade them for better stuff, street stuff or something. And so, anyway, I went to the doctor and said I was having nightmares. I was kind of hoping he would send me to a psychiatrist, but I wasn't going to ask for that. And so he said, oh, well, the drug salesman was here today, and he handed me 3 or 4 sample bottles of some kind of yellow pill and sent me on my way. And, oh, thank you very much. And then I moved somewhere, and so they were sort of in a box. Anyway, that day, one day on a Saturday, I started drinking in the morning, of course, because it was morning. And I drank all day long, and I was feeling very sorry for myself about some damn thing or other. And I remembered those pills, and I thought, there, they'll be sorry, I'm going to die. I'm going to kill myself, I'm going to eat all those pills. Because I've been drinking lots, and they say that even if you eat aspirin after you're drinking, then you can get sick. And I'm sure that if I eat all 3 of those bottles of those pills, I should die. So I did. I think, I'm not sure how many pills, but I do know. The next day, I came to, it was at mid-morning, and my phone was ringing, and somebody wanted a ride somewhere, and I picked up the phone, and I realized I can hardly talk. My tongue was all swollen up inside my mouth. I could hardly talk. And this person wanted a ride, and I agreed to go and give him a ride. So I got up, put my clothes on. I can't even imagine what I looked like. And I went and got him. And he was talking to me, and I was not responding. I thought, there's no way. I'm not talking. I'm just not talking, that's all. And so I drove him where he had to go and did whatever I had to do, and I went home. And I never told anybody. I was so embarrassed that I had lived through it. I thought, anybody with half a clue would have died. For God's sake, I can't even do this right. And so I didn't go to the hospital, but I probably should have. And so that's all I know about those 2 questions. So anyway, I start out, I'm going to change those yeses to nos. And I worked really hard the next year. I stopped drinking in the bar. I start drinking at home. So I wasn't drinking with lower companions anymore, right? So that's one that I can change. Sometime later, I realized I was the lower companion. but I was still drinking to blackout. I couldn't seem to get that one straightened out. I didn't know how to do that one very well. So, but anyway, so after a year of my mighty effort, I had changed one yes to no. And that's it. I was still driving cars in blackouts. I was still, you know, not being able to predict what would happen overnight. Anyway, and by then it didn't matter that the test was defective. I was beaten up. I guess I was just beaten up. So along comes November 1975, and my partner had won a trip for 2 to Hawaii, which is probably why he was my partner. I thought, if you're getting a trip for 2 to Hawaii, I'm going. And so to make sure that I got my ticket, I moved in. And we went to Hawaii for my birthday that year. And I met a woman who was the bartender at the poolside bar in the hotel we were staying in. And my routine by then was to go down to the beach, flip around in the beach because I didn't want to come home completely white. And I can only, you know, I can only vaunt my Swedish heritage for so long, and after a while somebody's going to say, but you've got no sunshine at all, and that's not possible. So anyway, that was my routine. I would go down to the beach for a little while, and then I'd go to the poolside bar, and I would have a couple of drinks, and I was really rigid about this. I would have 2 drinks at the poolside bar, and then I would go to the room, and I spent most of our holiday in the room drinking or fighting with my partner. And one night, and I somehow had developed this relationship with this woman at the bar. We can pick each other out of a crowd no matter what this scene is. And she started to talk to me about alcoholism. And by that time, the word alcoholic sort of sends a chill down my back. I get that, oops, it's way too close, way too much identification going on when I hear the word alcoholic. And she's talking about alcoholism because there's another woman that doesn't have the self-control I have. Who gets drunk at the poolside bar every day and flops around there in the blackout and nearly drowned a couple times and stuff. And so
Kimi's telling me about alcoholism, and I'm like, well, how do you know all this stuff, and why do you know all this stuff? And she said, well, I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I don't see you drinking. And she said, no. She said, I went to a treatment center in Los Angeles. Oh, I see. I thought, oh, well, there's all my hopes gone to hell. And she said, they offered two options for it. And I said, but you're not in Los Angeles anymore, so what are you doing now? And she said, they'd offered two options. One was Alcoholics Anonymous, and the other was Transactional Analysis. And she had chosen TA because AA made her feel guilty. And I thought it was very logical. But I knew that we didn't have TA in Vancouver in 1975. I just knew we were not that progressive. I did know, however, that we had AA in Vancouver because I had answered those stupid 20 questions a year ago. So my hopes were a bit dashed. I thought, oh dear. However, that was all well and good, except she came to work drunk one night. And then the next day she wanted to know if anybody had seen her. Was the boss into the bar? What did she say? Yak, 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 yak. I don't know, Kimi. I was drunk. It was the one night that I allowed myself to get drunk alongside of her. But it stuck in my mind. And we came back to Langley, and I, you know, bumped along for the rest of the month of November, December, whatever it was. And one morning, I got up, and I went to work, and it was the last day of work before the holiday. And traditionally, we would have a few drinks at work, and then we would go to lunch, and then we would go home, and we would see each other again after the new year. We shut the foundry down for the winter, for the Christmas holidays, rather. And that particular morning, I came to at home, and I was late for work. So I quickly got up and changed my clothes and raced off to work and grabbed the bottle out of the cupboard on my way to my desk. Had a few drinks to smart me up and went over to the bar with the guys. Had a few more drinks there. And then we went for lunch and I had some more to drink, of course. And I don't remember. I was supposed to be back at my place in Langley by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I have no idea how many drinks I'd had, and I still wasn't sober from the night before. I'm sure if they'd have given me a breathalyzer on the way to work, I should have been in jail. I'm sure I would have blown over 0.08 well, easily, very easily. So I had all these drinks, and then I was supposed to be home at 3 o'clock so that the babysitter caretaker could fly to her family's in Montreal. And the next thing I know, I'm driving into my carport in Langley, and it's 5, and I'm in trouble. And I knew I was in trouble. I knew I had screwed everything up, and I was instantly sober. And I came into the house, and my mom was there, and we were supposed to have a bunch of people over for dinner that night, and I wasn't happy. So I somehow got through that night, and I didn't have another drink. The next morning was Christmas, and I didn't drink Christmas Day. I was going through withdrawal, and I didn't know that. I had violent shakes, and I couldn't control it, and so when I thought somebody was noticing it, I'd grab a kid and throw it on my knee and bounce around with it for a while to kind of cover it up a bit. And I somehow got through that day and that night, and the next day I didn't drink. And we came up here because a friend of mine was getting married and I was going to be standing up for her here in Campbell River. And we came up here on that day, and I wasn't talking to anybody. I was terrified to even open my mouth. I didn't know what would fall out of my mouth, along with my dentures, I mean. I thought there was going to be snakes and worms of kinds I could never control, and I just didn't know what to do. I just kept my mouth shut. I didn't talk to anybody. And we arrived here, and it wasn't even all that noticeable by my partner that I wasn't talking to him. He knew I hadn't had anything to drink yet. But my, you know, this woman that I hadn't seen for a long time, and I was going to be, you know, standing up for her, and a friend of ours came up with us, a friend of hers and mine came up with us to Campbell River, and I wasn't talking to him, and you know, the guys went out to the bar that night and the girls stayed home and we were supposed to do girly things, I guess. And I sat curled up on the couch not talking to anybody and not doing anything and listening to them going on about whatever, them being whoever else was there. I honestly can't even tell you who was there. And the next day, the ceremony was sometime in the morning, late morning, and they were pronounced man and wife, and the bride's brother started passing out little drinks to do the toast with, and as soon as it touched my lips, I realized I had been dying of thirst for 3 days, for God's sake. And I moved to the punch bowl, and I just started dipping it out of there like I was dying. I thought I was putting out a fire, and I hadn't had a drink by then for 3 days. I thought I was cured. I thought I was cured. And we got into the cars and started heading back down the island, and I was in a blackout before we got to Courtney. I had a bottle, and I was just drinking out of that one. And I was in a blackout before we got to Courtney, and I know I made a scene on the ferry because it's what I do. And the next morning, and I believe we stopped somewhere for dinner. This is all, I'm putting this together again from the stories, the reports. Don't you love those ones? The reports you get the next day. Do you know? Yeah, I do know, so whatever. And then I came to, as we drove into our carport in Langley, and somehow made it into the house and into bed, and I don't know how long I was there, and came to, and you know, that sweaty cold, I need a drink, I can't stand it if I drink one more time, all of that stuff, the remorse and the shame. And my partner at that moment said, why did you have to get so drunk again? And I just got up. And I sat in the living room or the kitchen or whatever, and in the dark house, and just, you know, it was as if my whole life was flashing before my eyes. And, you know, if I could stand here and tell you that every time I got into trouble I had been drinking, I wouldn't need to be here. Because, you know, that's the way it is for people. Alcohol has a way of removing common sense and inhibitions. And non-alcoholics get into trouble when they drank too much. That's the way it is. But I looked at my life and I realized some of the stuff I did without having any excuse. And what I had just experienced the night before, that desperation, that terrible desperation, and that I knew that I would give away my children. I would leave my home. I would give up jobs. I would move out of an apartment into a car. I would do all of that to make sure that I had alcohol. That's when I knew I was alcoholic. It wasn't because I had 18 yeses on somebody's stupid questionnaire. It was because I gave up a life for alcohol, and I knew it. I knew it so clearly that morning. And I knew transactional analysis didn't work. Even if it was in Vancouver, and it probably wasn't. And I knew it didn't make any sense for me to go to California to the treatment center, because I knew there wouldn't be any of those in Vancouver either. I was to find out all that stuff later, but I knew that. I just knew it that morning that I had to call Alcoholics Anonymous. There was one other piece. My aunt is sober in Alcoholics Anonymous now, something like 35 years, but she lives in Alberta, and I had very little to do with her for obvious reasons. As soon as she went to AA, I thought, well, you're no fun anymore. No point in seeing you. But in any case, that was, I just knew that I had to call AA that day. But I was going to bargain one more time. The bride and groom were coming by the house on their way to someplace else, and so I thought, I'll just run it by her first and make sure. So she came in, and I don't think she even had her coat off yet, and I said, I'm thinking of calling Alcoholics Anonymous. I expected she would say, oh, you know, you just need a couple days. She said that would be a good idea. And so there was kind of the last escape route kind of shut down on me. But it was Sunday, and I knew that AA wouldn't be open because it was an office, and so I had to wait till the next day. But I did. I waited until the next day, and I didn't drink that night, and I wasn't fun. And I knew, I was 28 years old. I knew life was over. It was going to be boring forevermore, and dull, and painful. And maybe God would take me with some kind of a strange illness or something early, but I just didn't, that was it. That's all I knew. That was the sum and total. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous the next day from my office. And this woman phoned me back in minutes from Langley. And said her name was Elsie. And she said, "Do you think you're an alcoholic?" And I thought, oh, isn't this too bad? They're stupid, too. Is there another reason you'd be calling Alcoholics Anonymous? But I thought, well, that's your choice. That's it. What are you going to do? You got to go there. So I went to her house for coffee after work. and then I went to a meeting that night in Langley. It was actually in Surrey, on the Surrey-Langley border. And I walked into the meeting and I met exactly what I thought I would meet, old men. And old Bob was there. And he was missing fingers and he was rough and couldn't say anonymous. So I knew I was, you know, that's what my fate was going to be. There'd be me and all these old men that can't speak English and they're rough. And they talked about ego, and I said, I haven't got any. What are they talking about, ego? I don't have any ego. I just told you what I thought. I don't have any ego. I don't know what they're talking about. They talked about brain damage, and I thought, yep, I can see that. Fortunately, I stopped in time. They talked about God all the time, and I thought, I wish you'd shut up. I think maybe I'm going to get out from underneath this God thing somehow. I'm not quite ready to meet that one yet. And, you know, I wish you'd shut up. Because you know how it is. You keep calling somebody's name, they're going to show up eventually. And I'm not ready yet. And I have a lot of paying to do. And I'm just not ready yet. But they kept talking about God. You know, they read that opening thing that was read this morning. And, you know, and it's all about, that's all it says is, God, God, blah, blah, God, 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 blah, blah, God, 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 blah, blah. And then Bob asked me to share. He asked me if I'd come up and talk. So I got up to the front. I don't know what I'm going to say. So I stand up and I tell them my name because I heard everybody else say that. And I said, I think maybe I might be a little bit of an alcoholic. And so everybody that got up talked to me after that and told me I was. And I thought, oh, okay. They said, you don't arrive here by mistake. And I went, oh, okay. So I'm stuck here then, I guess. And I said, is this all we do now? Go to these meetings, eh? No. No, we have a dance on Saturday night. Oh, good. Dance, that'll be fun. There's New Year's after all. Well, I'm sorry, I have tickets to something. Anyway, that was my beginnings. That's what happened. What's it like now? Holy moly, what a difference. I didn't stay in that relationship for very long. I'm a quick study. I learned the language very quickly, very quickly. I also discovered that there's some cute-looking guys around here. They weren't all old men after all. Some of them were kind of cute-looking guys, and so I thought, well, maybe it would be okay. You know, I could stick around. And they had these dance things, and they had these roundup and rally things, and, you know, and they had these get-togethers in homes. And there was I thought he was an old-timer. He was 9 years sober. And he sounded like he was an old-timer, a guy by the name of Dennis, and his wife and family had moved to Langley, and he was in construction building what turned out to be the Sandman Hotel in Vancouver. And they were living in Langley on a farm, and they would have us all over to their place on Sundays. And there was, I'm one of the class of 75. There's another one here, but he was here in town, this town, when I was getting sober in Langley, but there was a whole bunch of us in Langley at that time that got sober together. And then there were some other people around that had been sober for a little while, and AJ's here, and he's one of those that had been sober for a little. He was one of the long timers. He was 11. And I don't even know why I remember that, Al, but it's the weirdest thing. I never forget how long you were sober when I got sober. I can't add it together today half the time. My math was better then or something. I don't know. Anyway, so we would go over to Dennis and Verla's place on Sunday nights or after any of these kinds of gatherings, these little roundups and rallies and things, and we would go and sit there and debrief at their place and watch how a sober family lived. And Dennis was a showman. He was a showman. I thought when I first met him, I thought he was in radio or something, because he had one of those deep radio announcer's voices and a slow-talking, slow-walking kind of guy. But he comes from a family of vaudeville performers, I found out later. But Dennis was a showman, and it was so great. It was just great. It gave me a place to be. It gave me people to be with. I found out that there were other people like me that were just newly sober, and they weren't old. They were my age, you know, some of them were a little bit older, and I wasn't the youngest either. There's that horrible question, you know, you come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous December the 29th. My first thoughts were, well, first group of thoughts were these. What will I do for Christmas? How will I handle that? And what am I going to do for fun? Because I've been having so much fun. What will I do for fun now? So, you know, those are the sort of things that happened in the first year, and we were adopted, and we hung out together. We formed a tight-knit group, and we went places together. We went to the roundups together. We traveled out of town together. We went to meetings together. We hung out together in each other's homes after. We talked on the phone in between meetings. My boss actually one day said to me, "You know what? I used to get more production out of you when you were drunk. Now you're on the phone all the time." I said, "Don't bother my sobriety, you know, don't upset me." I stayed with that company for the first 5 years of my sobriety, so I was with the company for 7 years, and I had never been with the company for that long before. And when I left there, they gave me, I left to go back to school. I decided what I needed was to be an academic. That was really the missing piece in my life. And they gave me a little motorcycle. I've always been involved with motorcycles at some level or other, so they gave me a little motorcycle. I had to sell my car to pay my rent while I was in school. So things did turn around, you know. I became a valuable employee. I could have gone back. They actually asked me to come back to work for them a couple of times after that. I became a valued employee. I had never been a valued employee before. I stopped coming to work smelling like the night before and sleeping off my hangover at my desk. I did finally stop talking on the phone all bloody day too. Got a lot of work done. My kids lived with their dad, and he raised them. You know, I'd been sober for a couple of years and thought, maybe I should take custody of my kids back, you know. After all, I'm their mother, and they should come and live with me. And I sat down with my sponsor, and I looked at the situation, and we agreed that that wouldn't be the best thing for the kids, that they were better off living with their dad, because he lived in the country. He lived next door to his mother's, his mom and dad's place, and all of his brothers and sisters lived out there, and they had an extended family that I couldn't give them. And what they would have if they came to live with me was maybe a two-bedroom apartment in Vancouver, and none of their extended family around them, and none of their familiar activities, and they wouldn't be able to have a German Shepherd dog, which they had, and we wouldn't be able to go camping every weekend or on weekends or for long weeks during the summer
like they do with their dad. And so their dad and I sat down and worked it out so that I would come and pick them up every other weekend and they would come and spend the weekend with me, but they lived with their dad in Aldergrove. And I think that I still believe today that that was the right decision. And I've come to terms with that. My parents, my mom used to write my address in pencil, and I'd send her about every other one. And now I'm written in pen. A few years ago, they asked if I would be the executor of their will and maintain their wills for them, and because they have come to trust that I am reliable, and that I'll be accountable, and that I'll do the right thing. I married and divorced in sobriety. My love life did not get cleaned up. That one took a little longer. My first year of sobriety, and I was sober, I guess, maybe about 9 months. And funny how a woman always remembers when something's been 9 months, don't you think? But I'd been sober about that long, and I met a man who was in the fellowship, and he had been sober for a number of years, and he was a counselor for a railroad, EAP counselor for a railroad. And he was charming and witty and very well educated, good looking, and very romantic. And I fell hook, line, and sinker, and we started to see more and more of each other. For the first 3 years of my sobriety, I was involved with this man, and I'm not going to go into the details. Never mind the details. Suffice to say that just before my third year of AA, we separated for the final time. But not before I had done some things that I couldn't believe I was doing. I had stopped talking to any other men because of his insane jealousy. I didn't want to do anything that would trigger his insane jealousy. I wasn't even talking to the gay men anymore, for Pete's sake, because he would be jealous. And then after that, I couldn't talk to certain women because he didn't like what they said and how they influenced me. So what happened was I became very isolated. And I was almost 3 years sober. And I was going to the Lost and Found group at the time. And I was secretary of that meeting. And I would go to that meeting, and I would have to report in. And he was driving me to work in the morning and picking me up at work in the afternoon and coming and having lunch with me every day. It was so nuts. It was so nuts. And one day, my kids were over, and my daughter and I were in the kitchen of the apartment. And he said something, and I fired a book at him. And Wendy said, "Why did you throw a book at Casey, Mom?" And I said, "Because I didn't have a knife handy." And he was walking down the hall, and I said, "But I do now." And I threw the knife. And I just pushed her aside and threw the knife. Fortunately for everybody, I've never been a good aim. So we both lived. But it was a week later that he moved his belongings to the hall closet again and stopped to argue the case. And I said, "Just keep him going. Don't stop this time. You just keep him going." And he moved out. And I hadn't had a drink. And one of my old drinking buddies phoned me right around that time, and we got together, and I was telling her what was going on, and she said, "I can't believe that." She said, "I just can't believe that you, what has happened to you? That would never have happened to you." I said, "I don't know. Something's happened to me. I've become completely incapacitated. I can't make a decision. I don't know what's going on. I've allowed this person to become my God." And I guess it was just in that saying that, "I've allowed this person to be my God," when I realized no human power can be my God. No human power. And I had to begin the quest for God, that search for the power that was going to make it possible for me to stay sober, to get sane, and restore me to that level of sanity that I had been promised in this program. And so I began then to go to women's meetings. It wasn't my plan. Like I said, I came here and I saw the cute guys and stayed. You know, I did not see, oh, look at all my sisters. I thought, oh, Jesus, look at those women. I looked at them and all I saw was competition. I never wanted to be next to another woman in a situation where you take a look and say, oh, look at, you know, that's, she doesn't compare very favorably, does she? And yet I was doing things that would make me compare very badly. I couldn't see that there was a parallel. But I went to women's step meetings, and I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful that they had them. They didn't have many, and the ones that they had, you had to bloody search out. That really made me mad. But I did find some. At that time, I was hanging around the North Shore Alano Club in Vancouver a lot, and they had a women's step meeting in the back room of the Alano Club, and I was able to access that one, and there was another one at the hospital. I'm just going to divert here just for 1 second. I hate lecturing. I don't like being lectured at. But I will say this. If you believe that women's meetings are necessary to the fellowship, for God's sake, don't hide them in your bloody living room. They need to be accessible. That's it. Take that off. Anyway, I went to those women's meetings and I started to hang out with women, and there was a bunch of us in North Vancouver that spent a lot of time together, and I found out that I wasn't unique, I wasn't alone, I wasn't the only woman that had acted this way. I remember one day going to a meeting, it was a few years later, I went to a meeting and thinking, you know what, your behavior has to stop. And my sponsor said to me that point, she said, and then of course I had a new sponsor, but she said to me, you must do everything in recovery that you did when you were drinking, else how would you learn how to do it right? And so I've had to do it all. I've had to try the geographical cures. I've had to try the changing men. I've changed cars lots of times. I've bought new outfits. I've changed homes, you know, changed jobs. I've had to do it all. And finally, when all else fails, I've come back to the steps. And so the steps have saved my life. I'm going to really quickly give you a summary of what it's been like over the last few years. A number of years ago, 20-some-odd years ago, a man came into Alcoholics Anonymous. No big deal. Everybody, lots of them do, every day. This particular one came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember meeting him when he was fairly newly sober. And over the course of the next few years, we were on different committees together, and we became good friends. And I went to work at Central Office. He was on the hiring committee. And I was hired to work at Central Office in Vancouver, and he, because he was involved in intergroup at that time, he was in the office quite a lot. And also, his sponsor was the manager of the office, and so Rick was in and out of the office all the time. And we became very good friends. My second marriage had ended before I went to work there, and we were, you know, negotiating a few times. It never did come back together again, but in any case, that's the way that was. Rick's marriage was failing, and to summarize this really briefly, we wound up dating after he was no longer involved in intergroup, and when his marriage had ended. And we were both of us quite nervous about that idea, because we'd been good friends. We'd worked on committees together. We'd been good friends. We'd been in service together for a long time. We got married about 9 years ago. Just about 9 years ago. We've been together for the last 14 years. And I'm a 5-year wonder. That's the best I've ever done before, is 5 years. And it's like Larry talked about last night. I've had to learn how to be a wife, not a doormat, not a servant, but a wife. Not the bearer of children either, thank God. Grandchildren, yes, but not children. But to be a wife in a spiritual and a mental and a physical capacity. I never knew how to do that when I got here. My mom and dad have been married for over 55 years. So it's not like I, you know, didn't have they've got some kind of a relationship going. Might not be the best, but it's certainly not the worst. But I don't know. I don't know about you, but my dad once tried to teach me how to play the guitar, and I just thought, if anybody else in the world was teaching me, I might learn, but not from you. Because he and I clashed all the time about everything. So, you know, whatever they were going to teach me about growing, being an adult, I wasn't going to learn from them. That's just the way it was. So I've had to learn from you. I've had to listen to how you do that so that I can try it and see if it works for me. I've had to learn how to be a mother. I brought my kids to these events. They were 5 and 7 when I got sober. I brought my kids to these events regularly. And they grew up knowing that Alcoholics Anonymous was for people who want to stop drinking and who want to stay stopped, and that there's some pretty nice folks here. And they're happy that I'm here. They're glad I don't drink. They don't even have any recollection of my drinking, but they were glad I don't drink. Sometimes, you know, I don't know that God is in my life in a big way lots of times. I'm just suiting up and showing up and doing what I'm supposed to do and reporting for business. But I'm going to tell you this one last story and I'm going to sit down. About 4, 5, 6 years ago, I guess, my son met a girl and they decided to get married. And I met this girl and all I saw was me in the old days. And I was really not very happy about his choice, but he chose to marry her. She kept leaving him for other men. She did that a few times. And she had done it one more time. This was about the third or fourth time she had left him for another man 2.5 years ago. And my first granddaughter was born, and my son and I were interacting at the time, and he told me he was going back to his wife. So I went back to her, and I wasn't happy about it, and subsequently a few things happened, and he cut off all communication with me. And so we didn't have any relationship for the following 2 years or so, a year and a half, 2 years. I didn't hear from him. I didn't have a phone number for him. I didn't know where he lived. They moved, they changed numbers and that kind of stuff, and I had no connection with him whatsoever. He was in his 30s. And his sister also was in the same persona non grata as I was, so there was the two of us not knowing where he was and so on. And then my daughter phoned me one day and she said, "Glenn's quite sick. They think he has cancer." And so that was just before Mother's Day last year. And so she phoned me a little while later and she said, "He's in the cancer hospital." So I went to the cancer hospital. I phoned the cancer hospital in Vancouver. I didn't know if that was the one he was in because he lives in Abbotsford. And they said, yes, he was there, and they would give him the message and he would call me back. And so he called me back and I went to see him while he was in the hospital. At the same time, that man that I married in AA and was married to for a few years, not the first one, but the second one, was also in the hospital, and he was dying, and he said he had a week or so left to live. And so I was visiting the two of them, because the hospitals are side by side. And John died in June, on June 10th, as a matter of fact. And Glenn had gone home, and I had not, and once again I had been cut off. I didn't know where he was. And Father's Day, I was out with, Rick and I were out with Wendy and Paul, and Paul said he'd had enough of this. Paul's my son-in-law. He said, this is nonsense. And he said, I'm taking you where he lives, and I'll show you where he lives and how to get there. He said, his wife isn't home. She's gone away for the weekend. So I went, and he was home alone, and the cancer was in his back and his lung. And so he was confined to a hospital bed in his house, and he couldn't access the door. He couldn't answer the door or anything, so I just went in. And I talked to him, and I said, I want to be able to talk to you, so you need to give me your phone number, and I promise I will only call during the day when she's at work. And so we did that, and I didn't talk to him about her, and I didn't talk to him about very many things at all. And but I was able to call him. So I could call him from work during the day, and we talked to him about going up to Nicola Lake with the family that summer because he hadn't been for a long time, and it used to be a favorite holiday for my kids and their dad and his wife. And so he went to Nicola Lake last summer, the last week of July. And Rick and I were at the Coombs Bluegrass Festival for the weekend, this weekend last year. And we decided on Sunday to go home rather than wait for Monday. So we'd have a day to, you know, be at home, relax, and get ready for work and stuff. And so we went home, and I'd had a shower, and we'd had dinner, and the phone rang. And it was my daughter-in-law, and she said, you better go to the MSA hospital. Gwen doesn't have very long to live. So we went to the hospital and started a vigil for the next 6 days as my son died. And throughout the course of that 6 days, I was able to stay in the hospital room with him. And his wife was there, and my daughter. And there was, you know, people in the room with him the whole time. And he was conscious for most of the time, and even when he started to slip into coma state, he would come out of it from time to time. And we were able to say goodbye to each other. And to know we loved each other. And I knew that whatever decision he had made, he'd had to make before that. And it was going to be okay. And when he died, I had left. His dad and I had left the hospital and gone to do some errands. And it was noon, and I knew I had to get back to the hospital. I just knew. And I was on my way back when the hospital called and said he was gone. And I went back and said my goodbyes to him then. And then the next week we did all the things that needed to be done, and had a memorial the following Saturday. There were 300 people at the memorial. Many of them were people who had never set eyes on my son. Many of them were members of Alcoholics Anonymous, there to support Rick and I in our time of need. And so when I think of spirituality and I think of God, I can't think the big father figure in the rocking chair in the clouds somewhere. I have to think of people like you who've been in my life for almost 28 years, walking with me on a daily basis through the times when I have been such a screw-up. Such a colossal screw-up, and you've loved me, and you've shown me how to be a better person. And the times when I've been in such deep, deep pain, I didn't think I could live through it. You've been there to hold my hand, and that's God for me. I thank you for my sobriety.